The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extern Problem Gambling. And my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with the project and the co-author of the book Tony 10. And today we are delighted to have with us our guest, Tony Parente, who's a recovering gambling addict and the founder of the UK, or rather England and Wales charity, GamLearn. And we'll be talking a little bit about what that charity does in a little while. But I mean, first starting off, Tony, thanks so much for joining us. And I suppose it's important because people could be listening to this at any time in the future. We're recording this on day two of Cheltenham 2022, which is, I don't know what it's like in England, because in Ireland, there's this kind of idea of an Irish takeover of Cheltenham, and so many Irish people travel over. Thousands and thousands of Irish people book the week off work. They have money put aside. They either go to the pub or they physically travel over to Cheltenham. And then there's this whole big thing about, oh, how many Irish winners will there be versus English winners? And it's a big thing here. I don't know if it's as big a thing in the UK as it is here, but here it's just off the charts nuts. And every time you turn on the radio, TV, open a newspaper, go onto your social media, it's just Cheltenham round down your throat. So it's interesting that we have the two Tony 10s, Tony O'Reilly, who is Tony 10, and Tony P10, both of whom had somewhat similar experiences with a very well-known gambling operator called Paddy Power, who have their head offices in Ireland. I think your experiences were about 5 years apart, but I'm just setting the stage here for people who might not know everybody's stories. Tony Parente's story is very much in the public domain. Was it Panorama that did?
Panorama in 2019, I think it aired, yeah.
Yeah, and that was a really interesting documentary, and I'd highly recommend anybody to go and have a look at that as well. So, Tony Parente, thank you so much for joining us today. Starting out, I mean, do you want to just tell us about how you got into gambling in the first place?
Yeah. And firstly, Barry, Tony, thank you for inviting me to come onto this and to share a little bit about my journey. So I appreciate that. So I suppose my gambling journey started at quite a young age. In terms of actually going into a shop and gambling, my first bet was at 16. In a William Hill betting shop. I'd picked horses for my granddad when I was younger and picked lottery numbers for him. And crazy, he actually said I was a lucky boy. It didn't develop like that. But and things like penny up the wall and fruit machines as a young kid was sort of done really early on. But actually in a betting shop, my first shot bet was at 16. William Hill betting shop, never been in one before. Older friends used to gamble. It was quite a societal thing in the area that I lived in. Lots of friends did it. And he asked me to pick a horse from the race that was up on the screen. And I never knew what odds were and how to put a bet on, but a name just came out on the screen to me, Finsbury Flyer. I'm an Arsenal fan. It was red and white colours, I recall it was wearing red and white. And I just told him to put a fiver on it for me. I looked back at that race recently, a few years ago, as in just Googled and saw, and it said it fell out of the stalls and came up on the outside on one on the line. And even now, talking about it, my heart beats that little bit faster. And that's the feeling that gave me in that shop at that time. It wasn't about the winnings, and it was about that roller coaster of a couple of minutes. And it won, obviously, at 33-1, which was back then when you used to pay tax. That's how long ago it was. And he said to me, well, I won't say the word, but he called me lucky and said, like, it's won. This is the price you can get, £160-odd. Gave him the slip. He collected the money for me. And we went straight next door to our local pub. And I thought, that was easy and this is great. But I think that's the first interaction with gambling, that first bet, it was a feeling that I had never had before. It really was. It was that injection. I fell in love with gambling on that day. Absolutely fell in love with gambling. And it wasn't something that consumed my life quickly, but it was something that I still sort of started doing more regularly and trying to learn a little bit more about it and knowing all these other things that you could bet on, dogs and football matches, and I think a game called Lucky 49 or something like that. It was something that I sort of engaged in days off from work when I went to work, weekends. The football team, we used to have accumulators and start picking football, everyone was doing it, and then watching your Sky Sports and the results coming in and things like that. But always something that I thought was okay, I could afford to do. I was a fantastic saver when I was younger, absolutely fantastic saver. I had my little bit of betting on the side, but still saved and still was able to sort of buy my first place at 21. But over the years, it became something more aggressive, but something I would do a lot more, straight after work, during my lunch break, at the weekend, took priority over things, not going straight next door after one bet, staying in there and continuing the bet. But like I say, never thought it would be or was a problem at the time, or what I was doing was wrong. No one thought that, it's friends gambled, but maybe not to the amount of the extent of time that I was, but most of my friends were gambling at the time.
And at what point do you think it kind of turned a corner and became a problem? It's amazing, the story that you tell, the amount of people that I've worked with over the years, I'm sure Tony O'Reilly's the same, that you've heard the stories where, like that, somebody goes in age 14, 15, 16, first bet, and it clicks at high odds. And like that, 160 quid for 16—that's a lot of money,
yeah,
out of thin air, And you say the exact same words that so many other people say. This is easy, which, it's easier than working. It's easier than digging dishes, working down a gold mine or whatever. Somebody hands you 160 quid for picking the right horse. Like, that's—it makes a huge impression on an impressionable young mind. And the thing of going there with an older family member, and then a lot of people kind of fit, especially men with sports betting, you feel like a man, you put a lot of wad of cash in a young fella's pocket, and he starts feeling like Billy Big Balls all of a sudden.
Yeah, I think ego played a big part of it at that time. I had a part-time job, and that was like a week's salary in one hit, instead of stacking shelves at the local supermarket wearing that terrible uniform and things like that. This is easy and this is fun. It's words like that to a young man that were impactful really, really quickly on my mind.
You also think it's the way that it happened as well, Tony, because I know that the money side of it is like, this is easy, it's a week's wages, or but I think also the way it happens, I think, because mine's well documented, the Burkamp goal in the 98 World Cup. I was doing a school yesterday, and every time I look at the goal, when I show the goal through the presentation, I do get that sense of that buzz that you talked about when you re-looked at the race. But I think it's the way it happened. It was the 89th minute, like you're watching Arsenal Liverpool tonight, if someone scores in the 90th minute and even hits the post and goes in, you get more of a buzz, or even for a penalty shootout. So I think when you put the two of those together, it's a cocktail for addiction, I suppose, want of a better way of putting it, because it's how that goal went in. It was a cracker of a goal. It was the 90th minute. It was to get into the semi-final of the World Cup. Your horse fell out of the stall, probably came at the end and won by a neck. So I think it's also not just the money, but it's, as you said, that feeling you get from that pure adrenaline rush from watching it come from behind to win. So I think, Barry's right, the amount of people we talk to, 90% of most gambling people's stories, or people's gambling stories, sorry, are very similar in that big win, but how it happens and what it means to them at that time. And I think that's when we internalized that and then kind of going, I want more of that. And that was the that was the three words that really ran around my head that night. This is easy. And I think, yeah, I think it's just, it's mad that there's so many similarities of all these stories of how people get into this.
Yeah, I look back and think, I wish it never went won. But I think even if it didn't, that adrenaline, that process, I think it maybe may have made, knowing me back then, I may have had another bet. But it did really start in that shop with a win. And it was lasting. You know, it was lasting on me.
And when do you think, because you were saying you kind of started out, and this is fairly classic as well, there's this idea in addiction theory of the four phases of gambling, and the early phase, the first phase, the winning phase, you know, and that obviously doesn't mean that you're winning all the time because that's impossible, right? But you're having wins, and maybe you don't hand over all your winnings, right? So whatever winnings you have, maybe you go and spend them on something else, or if you're good at saving, maybe you stick it into savings, right? It's the winning phase. And then people start spending more time, which you said, it started progressively, you start spending more time. The more time you spend in the bookies means you're doing more bets, which statistically speaking means you're going to lose more money, right?
Yeah.
More bets you do, you know, you can win an individual bet. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Walk out the door with your money, you're a winner. If you do 100 bets, you're walking out the door with with less money than you walked in with. Pretty much guaranteed. Like, just the laws of probability would state that. Again, occasionally that you can have blips in that, but the more time you spend gambling, the more losing you're going to do. It has to work that way.
Absolutely,
And then goes on to desperation and hopelessness. And, you know, they're pretty well defined and well observed phases that most people go through, you know. So you're going through that winning phase. The losing phase then, okay, you'd bought your own place at 21, which is absolutely amazing. And most people in Ireland listening to this will be living with their parents until they're 41. But look at the housing situation at the moment. So it's just, it's mind boggling. But there was a time when people who saved regularly and worked hard could actually do stuff like that. Maybe not so much in Ireland. So you're 21, you got your own place. You're good at saving. The gambling is progressing more and more, which would be normal, certainly for anybody who develops a problem or an addiction. Like, at what point, like looking back, do you think it started getting out of control?
It's a hard question to answer now. It's an easier question to answer now, but because I know earlier on it was a problem. You know, I know earlier on there were signs there. It was, you know, from betting my own money to then sometimes spending all my wages and then going to a credit card and withdrawing on a credit card, running over, you know, even like running over to the machine, then you get run over, taking out, running, you know, that was signs then, like, what are you doing? Like this rush to sort of get a bet on. And so that was a sign then, starting using credit cards and then writing cash checks out to the bank. You know, this is how long ago it was, to get more of my money out, and then loans to clear credit cards. And the signs were there so early looking back, but I didn't see that back then. I wasn't realizing what I was doing. I wasn't, the time, the consumption of time, like, not only, you know, I became a father at 21 as well, not spending time with my family, my son, my loved ones. These were signs, like the signs were really there early on. You know, if someone was to tell me what they were doing is what I was doing at 21, 22, I'd say, I think we need to like look at this, and you know, we need to work out why you're doing this. Why are you spending this much time? It's not just about, you know, money. I know obviously the figures with my own personal story and that, you know, the telephone numbers, but it's the time. It's the time I was taking that I should have realized then that this was becoming a problem, you know, and my relationship with it was not good. It wasn't a good relationship. It's the longest relationship gambling I've ever had. my wife might listen in on this, and she's closely catching it, but it was over 2 decades, you know, this relationship. And it's the relationship I gave more time to than any other relationship. It's the relationship that I always went back to. It's one that I was loyal to. It's one definitely that took more money from me than any other relationship. Although some ex-girlfriends may be close to it. But no, in all seriousness, it was just, I should have realized earlier, but I just didn't. And maybe when I share when that moment came for me, people will think, how did you not realize at this stage or at that stage? Or, you know, why did it take that particular moment? I can't describe why, apart from the fact that it was like an out of body experience. It was like something has literally taken me in to have that last bet, and it was scary, you know. It really was scary. And the things that I've done, I should have realized earlier on. And I'm not envious, I'm not jealous, I'm more envious about people now that can talk about this and discuss it and have that conversation earlier on in their life and in their engagement with gambling. I love it. I'm envious of them that they've got the strength to do that, because I just wish I did at that time. But there wasn't maybe the support there is out there. There wasn't the lived experience that there is out there, which I think is so important, like it is now. You know, if you're a young person or any person, you could go on most social media platforms and connect with someone that's potentially going to give you some life-changing advice. And it's hard not to look back without regret that I did that. And you know, we can't move forward with our lives holding regret. But I wish I'd seen those signs earlier on. There were so many just flashing in front of my eyes. But the thing that was flashing in my eyes more than that was having a bet, getting that bet on, those screens, that interaction, that race, that match, like Tony said, that match. That was just telling me this is more important than everything else.
Yeah, and it's amazing how you zoned in on the time there, because people, the first thing they think of is money when they think of gambling, obviously, that makes sense. But you know, the time away from family, friends, loved ones, the preoccupation. So even if you're in the room with those people, your mind is elsewhere, you know, impacts on your work, impacts on all your different relationships, impacts on your sleep, impacts on your physical health. It's taking all of these things, you know, I often put up this post on our Twitter, you know, the money is the least valuable thing you can gamble with, you know, like,
yeah.
It is important, and it has a hugely, you know, devastating impact on the lives of people with severe gambling problems. But that's just one part of it. You know, if you're fit and healthy and you're, you know, competent at something, you can get a job and make more money, or you can get money from the state through social welfare. Can you rebuild your relationships?
Yeah.
That's got a much, much bigger project, I think, for a lot of people.
It takes a lot more time. It's, you know, we talked about my son before we came on air, and my daughter as well. It's those things that I've missed out on. You know, I went overseas when my daughter was less than 9 months old to get away from gambling, to try and work and to try to rebuild our lives. I missed her calling. I missed her first steps. I missed my son's birthdays. I left my son, you know, 6 years old, and missed parents' evenings, missed, like, we're building our relationships, all of us together, again, from scratch. And that takes time, you know, getting the trust of your loved ones again, you know, being reliable and there for them, you know, especially like my kids, like them feeling that now. And some relationships haven't been mended and haven't been repaired, and I have to accept that, and I have to understand people's reasonings for that. But you know, all I can do is try my best now to do that. But gambling took all of that away, you know, and that's a sad thing, you know. It's I lived with a lot of shame and guilt of putting gambling before those sort of things, you know. Even maybe I don't want her to listen in, but even during my wife's labour, I was downstairs telling her that I needed a break because I wanted to get on a bit. How bad is that? You know, how bad is that? And there she is going through probably the, I know for her, most unbelievable experience and bringing the most precious things in the world to her for the first time. And now I'm saying, you know, I need to take a break from this. Like, my God. But that, you know, that's what gambling can do to some, and not to everyone, but it did to me. And I'm grateful that I've got the relationship I've got with my family, my wife, and my children, especially. And it's slowly, and you know, one day at a time, as they say.
So much what you're saying really resonates around the time element of, because like even when I'm sharing my story in the school presentations, it's, I say like gambling tarnished all the biggest moments of my life, and you spoke of a lot of them there. And you know, it's amazing how it can take the shine off your birth of a baby or a wedding or a new promotion in work or whatever it might be, or even just that moment when you're sitting connecting with your child or your partner, and it might be just the simplest of things. And one story I remember even telling, that in my early recovery, where when I remember we was in Tramore, which is just outside Waterford, it's a seaside resort, and I was up picking, my daughter was picking stones on the beach, and my head was still racing, and I was kind of going, you know, picking stones, but part of me wanted to go over to the amusements and just distract myself over here. And I remember I just said to Mom, I go to the music. She said, no, Daddy, I just want to stay here and pick up stones. And she just wanted to connect in that way, just to be present with her in the simplest of forms. But I think part of my head was so busy, I had to distract myself in other ways. And I think recovery, kind of longer term recovery, me has, I struggle with it still at times, that ability to be able to be fully present in each moment. And you can get overwhelmed with work or with different situations, or even with Twitter, or being in this space kind of stressful, as you know yourself. So sometimes it's just the ability to be able to pull yourself back and just really connect to what's important. It sounds like you're really enjoying that part of life now, the bit that you can reconnect with family, reconnect with, you know, reconnect with your wife, reconnect with friends. Like, you know, I'm meeting up with a few friends tonight to watch the match, and it's kind of like, just, it's amazing just to kind of go there and not to be a slave to my phone. Because sometimes when you're in that situation, you see people running out to the bookies, and especially this week there'll be people talking about Cheltenham and all that stuff. Like, I can switch off and that's fine. But for so many people, you don't get to enjoy moments like that because you're so engrossed in this screen or this need to place this bet on. And then when you're talking about running across the street to get out money, like, it brought me right back to a certain street in Carlow, running down trying to get that bet on, as if this was, you had to do this or your life was in danger. It's like that. And running while you're ringing in the bet and knowing your 16-digit credit card number off by heart, and being able to order it to the person while phone betting before internet.
Yeah.
So it's, and I when you mentioned time there, like I wouldn't usually count up the amount of time that I'm away from gambling. Like sometimes you kind of say, geez, yeah, I'm so many months or years. But I'm now coming close to, like, I had my first bet at 24, but I'm now coming closer to, I'm actually nearly coming up to being longer in recovery than I ever was even gambling. And I don't even mean gambling addiction. And for me, that's going to be the last kind of milestone I'd celebrate. It'll be kind of, you know, I'm longer now in recovery than I was in gambling. And for me, that'll be kind of like, I'll retire at that stage. I think I'll just kind of go that way. Because I think at some stage we have to put that stick down and move on and have that peaceful regret, I think, as one of the nuns in Coomberry used to say to me. And to be able to kind of say, I've missed out on all this stuff, but now I'm in a position to be the best version of myself going forward. And I'm sure your family at this stage are really benefiting from the new Tony.
And
being there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like what you say about your daughter, I think kids especially, they know. They know if you're present. They know if you're engaged. And I'm not going to say I'm a saint, you know, work and Twitter and this space that I'm in, I do get sidetracked. I do take calls on the weekend and try to help people. I do try to speak to as many people as I can. I've slowed down over the years because I felt it was taking, again, up a lot of my time, which is important for me and my family. you know, when we were allowed out at Christmas during my stay in the rehab, and my daughter, so this is 2017, 5 years ago, she was seven, and she said, "Daddy, it's been lovely just to spend time with you, you know, real time." And that was like 7-year-old girl saying that, and knowing that at that moment I was so present. It is lasting, and yeah, like I say, we do get distracted, but in what we do, and for me, you know, what I do is part of my own recovery as well. But I try to be present, and like you say, we spoke about the Cheltenham and what it's like for the people in Ireland. My God, did I love a Cheltenham week? You know, it was so important. You know, people fly from Ireland to go to Cheltenham. I flew from Dubai to go to Cheltenham. You know, I flew from Dubai. That's what it was like. And you know, a year, 2015 tomorrow was when I was in that box with Paddy Power. You know, a year tomorrow in their box and doing those things, and I would fly back from Dubai to Cheltenham, not home to see my family who are back in the UK first. It was Cheltenham, get that out of the way, then get the football out of the way on the Saturday, and then go and see them and spend the day with them and then fly back. You know, it's just, and how my wife just put up with that, you know, but I probably made her feel bad about, oh, well, this is my time, I deserve, you know, the manipulation then, I work hard and this is, but it was Cheltenham, you know, it is a huge thing, and I'm sure during this week, people are going to struggle and are going to reminisce, you know, just like what I just did there with that experience. You take your money, you have your pot, you know, it's never the pot that you're going to stick to, and there's always the card also in the back pocket and the extra card. But yeah, it's an event I know in Ireland. It's huge racing. You know, the people I've spoken to in Ireland now with horse water, you know, that is something that someone said to me, if you don't have a horse in Ireland, Tony, it's like not having a bike. Like, you know, she was saying that in a village, and I thought, Jesus, wow, that must be tough, really tough.
It's just when you were telling that story, the guy was in the box with Paddy Power as well, but it was in the Budweiser Irish Derby, and it was one of those moments where we look at each other and he knows and I know, and it's kind of like, I don't want him standing and he doesn't want me standing, because he knew what they were doing was wrong and I knew what I was doing was wrong. But I'll never forget, I got the free tickets and I bought some of my friends to it, and they were saying, how did you get these tickets? Oh, I won them, you know. And well, my best friend Niall, he was he was in the next box hanging out with JP McManus taking selfies with him, and they were delighted we're getting this Bollinger champagne, and he still talks about it today. And like, he's one of these people that takes the week off, and like, I text him, see if he's going for the match, and he said, no, and I'm on it Thursday and Friday. I'm like, jeez, oh yeah. And then I just remembered it was Cheltenham week. And for a lot of people, that is their week off, and they enjoy it. And even when I was flicking through the channels yesterday, it was just Rachel Blackmore was coming in with Honeysuckle. She'd won. Now, I didn't even know that Honeysuckle was the name of a horse, because I'm so distant from it. But you can see that people really enjoy it, and it's part of their enjoyment, part of their week. Maybe my friend Niall used to take the week off and used to just go drinking and gambling for the week. And it's not a problem for him. So for a lot of people, it is really enjoyable and it's great and they're really interested in it. Talking to one of the school teachers there yesterday when I was doing the school in Dublin, he listened in on the second presentation, and he was talking about the horse authorised that I, you know, had to win for me to pay for the wedding. He was telling me that actually Tiger Roll is some breed now of authorised or something. I didn't know any of that. I was kind of going, yeah, I have no interest in any of that stuff, but he had a real interest in it. And it's good for people to have that interest. And even yesterday, now, when I just flicked on the station, I'd never stay too long on any of these things, because it was just her talking in the interview, and you could see the energy and the crack. And it is a huge thing for thousands of Irish people, and it's a great entertainment for them. But we also have to be very mindful of the likes of myself and yourself and so many others who this week in particular sometimes can be very triggering. And it's very important to kind of mind ourselves in around that. And I think when you do start reconnecting to family in recovery, which is hard work and it does take patience and the trust needs come back and it is difficult. I think when we do start reconnecting to other things, it's not that sport becomes less, but I think we can look at it in a different perspective so that our life isn't about nearly getting knocked down by a car to place a bet or having to go in and watch a sporting event. We can pick and choose and enjoy it for what it is. Like you said, you're going to the match tonight. That's about that connection. And for me, going out to watch the match tonight, you know, I'll be shouting to the team, of course. It's about connecting with the lads. Like, I don't feel like I have to go down and get drunk to watch the match. I can go down and drive down and have a 7-up. And it's about the connection back with people. And that's the most important, because that's when we enjoy moments, when we connect. And for a lot of people, that horse racing or Cheltenham is that connection. There is that crack or banter, whatever you want to call it. But for me, it's different now. It's not about sport. I do love, don't get me wrong, I love watching sport. I love that's it. But for me, it's one part of my life that's important. But it's also, there's so many other things that are important. Like Liverpool, Arsenal tonight, whoever wins, I'll sleep up in the morning. I'll be collecting my daughter on Friday. I'll be looking at her playing a soccer match, which means more to me to do that at 11. And even sitting down playing FIFA with her, that's our bit of connection with football. We try to beat every team 25-0. especially, it was usually Man United that we play against. And she really enjoys that. And she's the goal scorer and I'm the tackler. And that's the bit of connection. I wouldn't have had that years ago, because I wouldn't have had the patience to sit down and play that or go for a cycle in the evening. And this is the important bit. And I think you say, like, at what stage do you recognise this problem? And you're dead right. It is a very loaded question, because it can be at any stage, because you can look back and say, yeah, there. Oh, yeah, actually, that was it. And it is about time that we neglect with other people or with our work or whatever, or school or college. But also the big one you said there that really resonated with me is that when I started gambling on credit, and I started that straight away from my online account, that was the key, because you're gambling with money that's not yours.
Yeah.
It's borrowed money. And that's a very dangerous recipe. Add that to in-play betting where emotion can come in, or online betting where you have access to it 24 hours a day. There's so much mix match. And then if you do have other stuff that's going on in your life as well, where you might be, you know, it could be stress, anxiety, insecurities, whatever else. If you add that into the mix as well, where gambling gives you that lift or that buzz, it's kind of like everything lines up for this to become a huge problem.
It's a recipe for disaster,
exactly.
Tony P, Tony Parente, too many Tonys. Not enough Tonys on here today.
I've got to say this. I was thinking about it this morning. In a GA meeting, many years, there was 4 Tonys in our meeting and only about 16 blokes. And I just said, don't name your son Tony. You know, you have any kids, don't name them. Like, you know, 4 of us in there. But anyway, that's just what I said.
I was the same, actually, in the GA meeting. I was in prison. There was a couple of Tonys used to come in from the outside. There was Tony R and Tony, well, it could have been a female Tony P and a Tony. Again, they might have nicknames on each of them. It was brilliant. Like, so there are, I think there are a few Tonys out there.
Three of the 4 were bald. So it's not... You're all right, Tony.
Yeah, maybe naming your child after St. Anthony could get you into trouble with gambling. So anyone out there having male children, don't call them Tony or Antonia for the girls. But Tony Parente, I mean, you mentioned going to Dubai there. So, like, what was the genesis of that? What was that, because you were in financial difficulty at home? You went to work out there?
Yeah, in 2010... I was gambling heavily. I borrowed money off family and friends. And again, this is another sign to stop, but it wasn't. And I got into some financial difficulty. And I thought running away was the answer. And it could have been. It wasn't running. I had no job lined up or anything like that. But I wanted to get out of the UK because I didn't want to be able to gamble. And there was... At the time, it was a choice between New York or Dubai, the Middle East. I knew in Dubai there was no betting shops. And it was a decision I made in 3 days. Just, you know, things were becoming unbearable. And I flipped a coin, you know, to decide where I was going to go. And it was Dubai, and it was to get away from gambling, to try to earn as much money as I could. There was opportunities to earn money tax-free. The draw was there with both. It, you know, like I said, I tossed the coin and it was Dubai. And it was, I was right. You know, there was an betting shop in sight. which was great. I wasn't engaging in online gambling like I did. I probably did open a couple of accounts, but it was, for me, it was always betting shops. So when I went to Dubai and thought, right, fantastic, and got a job very quickly and started to earn money that I've never been able to earn before and pay back debt, I then found online. I found online gambling and a way to gamble online and open an account. And again, that same thought process as a young 16-year-old, well, I'm paying debt, I'm earning money, I'm just going to gamble a little bit. You know, even after having to leave my family at the drop of a hat and try to get a new life for us still out there, I engaged in gambling and online gambling. And very quickly, in my time out there, I became a VIP customer with Ladbrokes. And I got this email saying, you know, free bets and free money's been put into your account. I thought, that's a bit unusual. But I thought, I'll grab it. And I wasn't gambling to the extent that I ended up gambling, but I was gambling a lot. And then they wanted to come and visit me in Dubai and come out and take me to the Dubai World Cup and meet me and bring some friends. And that was it. You know, that was the start of, I don't know what it was. I still think, was it? Well, I know things that it definitely was. I felt that I had to be loyal to this customer, this betting company. They were giving me all these great things. But, you know, I've done an analysis on my betting activity and like the spike went up like that within months of me becoming this VIP. And you know, even saying it, VIP, it's just so pathetic. I was a mug punter. That's what I was. I wasn't no VIP. But again, you say about the signs, why was I doing that? Why was I justifying doing it and still continuing to be it after that had happened in my life? But I did. And that was, like I say, those from 2013 to 2016, 2017 was the worst period of my life, both mentally, financially, the things I did, than ever before. It's scary, like scary. And the reason I found the online account is I used to miss soaps when I was in Dubai, like EastEnders, Hollyoaks, Corrie, things like that. And I got this VPN to be able to get ITV plan and catch up and all that stuff. And that's when I thought, well, let me try, see if I can get onto an account. Because when I did it before, I said, this is restricted. You know, this is not allowed. And that's when I did. And and that's, you know, again, hid it from everyone. No one had a clue I was still gambling or anything like that. It was always that hidden thing for me, you know, my interaction with it, especially going out there. Yeah, I stopped and I'm not going to do that. And the life that I was living out there, what people probably saw, but what was on the inside was totally different. You know, the job and the lifestyle, I suppose, but what was actually going on inside of me was, it was like, you know, battling like what is real and what isn't real. And the mask, always to put up that mask was so easy. You know, everything's okay, everything's fine. And, you know, people, you know, then my wife came out there and things like that. A crazy time, but I can tell you so much about it. But if you want to ask, it's probably better because I'll be here for the next 3 hours.
Yeah, so okay, ironic, it's one of these tragic ironies that you go out to Dubai, a place where all gambling is illegal, whether it's retail or online, so they have it blocked, the IP address is blocked at a country level, but like that, because you were using a VPN, to watch UK TV channels, which would have geo blocking on them, like the BBC player and the ITV player and stuff like that. You then chanced your arm to see if you could use the VPN to set up an online account, and that works. Yeah, you know, it's horrible how sometimes these things line up. Then you're getting VIP treatment. Now, for anybody listening, because, you know, there are different levels of VIP treatment. Tony O'Reilly got, you got a little bit, but you didn't get a huge amount, if I remember correctly.
No, mine was kind of, I was brought to the Europa League final in Dublin and the Budweiser Irish Derby in Dublin. Now, you probably talk about the end of May and probably the end of June as well. So they were the only two. I got a lovely diary off them as well, with kind of gold leaf pages on them as well, which is really nice that, you know, he couldn't use, because people say, what are you doing with a big Paddy Power diary? You only get the pocket ones. You have this big black one with gold colored pages. But I fully believe, and again, just my opinion, that they knew where the money was coming from. So they restricted the kind of the VIP level that my gambling should have warranted, I suppose. Like you look at your own story and other people's that we've heard over the years, that, you know, they were given huge amounts of money in their account. I think I got €500 put in my account once, or maybe €1,000 another time. That was the only free bets I ever got. I didn't get any free spins, or I could have got €250 into a casino account one time. It was actually when my sports betting had dropped, when I had no way of putting money electronically on it. Because when I started my online gambling, I had to lodge money electronically through a debit card, a credit card. So when I had maxed out any ways of getting those funds, my gambling definitely did change. I went back to kind of, you know, maybe doing some more mad accumulators to try to get the big amount, but my online gambling definitely dropped. But then suddenly I logged on, and there was this bonus in the casino. So it wasn't in sports betting, but it was on the casino site, which you could transfer between the two. but definitely, like, the VIP status, I believe that it was at the real back end of my gambling. Like, you know, I went to the Budweiser Irish Derby on a Sunday and my news came to light on a Wednesday. So it wasn't like I got it in early stage. I got right at the back end of the addiction. I don't know what that was for, but I do honestly believe that they knew where the money was coming from. And that's why maybe they didn't push that bit. And in honesty, I would have probably pulled back from that because I knew where the money was coming from as well.
Yeah.
So I wasn't kind of looking for the bonuses or looking for the box seats and wherever. Where some people will bring up looking for bonuses or will look for different things as well. It was nearly like that standoff that I spoke about when Seven Paddy Power kind of met face to face. Was that kind of, I didn't want anything to rock what was there because I needed to be able to do that to try fix the situation.
Yeah.
I believe that maybe they knew as well, and they didn't want to push too much as well because they knew the situation, or maybe they didn't know what to do with it. I don't know. Only they can answer that if they want to come on to the podcast and explain.
You're very welcome anytime. Sorry, Timothy.
I have so many theories in my mind, like, when did they actually know? You know, because I didn't plan on stealing money and defrauding people to fund my gambling. I never had that intention. It was always about my own money first, or borrowed money and stuff like that, and money that I could pay back or was due in, especially in Dubai, because it was a commission-based job. So you would transact on deals, but then you'd be paid later and then transferred and things like that, because it's property. But I got this treatment that I just, you know, it could have been a wage, you know, £1,000, £1,500 a week, £3,500 for my 35th birthday, £100 for every year. Flights to the UK business class, offers to go to the World Cup in Brazil, I think it was. Mayweather flight tickets for Mayweather at Vegas. Things that just were just ridiculous. And I knew what I could get from them as well. You know, I put a bet on that was a glitch in the system. It was 2 furlongs out. This horse was like 30 lengths clear. And I was just putting as much as I could on, and it allowed me. And, you know, they wouldn't pay me and said it was a an error, and then I moaned and said I'd leave, and they paid me like the £22,000 winning. They just knew it was going to come back to them. Like they knew that was coming back, and I don't think they thought at that time this guy's gambling with stolen money, or this guy's using money. How it escalated from what it was, and that, you know, I won't give, but it was in the hundreds of thousands first year, and then in terms of net losses, and then the 1.2 million in the second year net losses. So that spike, they must have, how they wouldn't have questioned that. But like I said, I was a mug punter. You know, you give me that, you're getting it back. That I remember the Friday is when we had a day off. You know, Friday was our Sunday in Dubai, so you don't work. Friday morning, I'd get my email with my bonuses. And you told me there about casino. I never went to the casino like some gamblers do. But for some reason, online casino took my gambling to a level I never, ever could have imagined in terms of time, spend, interaction with it. You know, I was 3-4 hours in front. So when I'm waiting for the racing to start, what am I doing? I'm playing online casino. I'm playing blackjack. I'm playing roulette. Never was a slot player, you know, but probably did engage in it at some time with a free spin. But so I've got then from 8 o'clock in the morning, my time, 9 o'clock, which would have been 5 a.m., 6 a.m. here, waiting till the first race or the first match. And that, yeah, I, you know, how they didn't know. And, you know, I can talk a little bit about when I dip, like that first dip into that fund that I manage, like, and where that took me and not knowing I could not replace it and there wasn't money coming in. And then that was it. I was off. And one of the clients said to me, if you had told me earlier, we could have worked through it. You know, we could have. But I didn't. And then that escalated to, you know, what's been publicly out there, over millions of pounds of fraud. And yeah, people might say, you loved it, Tony, when you were getting all the free bets. Of course I did, because I was a gambling addict. You were giving me more bullets. How could I not say no? Like, you know, it's, if you're hungry and someone gives you a pie, you're going to eat it. Like, that was what it was for me. And even when I took a break, you know, and I did take a break because after a year of being on this scheme, I could see how much I had escalated, and I asked for a break. I said, look, I need to take a break from this. You know, it's this saying, take a break, Jesus. Saying it now, you know, it's like I should have just said, lock me up. But I said, I'll take a break. Even during 2014, August to January 2015, I got sent £14,000 worth of free money that I was just withdrawing and withdrawing without placing a bet. I tried to stop that. It was my first real attempt at stopping gambling. And then they sent me £5,000 on January the 2nd. And they said, Tony, you can't just withdraw this money. You've got to turn it over. You know, and I did. But I'm not going to hold them fully responsible for it. Those 5 months of not gambling was a battle. It was, I was doing it for everyone else, but not for me. I was fighting not having a bet, not the ease of not wanting a bet. And just, I was fighting it. And so that was my green light. That was my, here you go, you can do this. And, you know, I should have closed the account in August and said, and not got this. But I thought, well, you know what, I've come out of money, I've done, why not just keep getting this free money? But I gambled that 5,000 in January. And that day I gambled over £52,000. And that was it. I was back. Yeah, I was back in action. And that year, I stole money. And I gambled with stolen funds.
Yeah, just like a lot of, sorry, Barry, there's a lot of that kind of resonates with my own story. But I think the guy was at a conference a while ago and it said for fraud to happen, there has to be opportunity, rationalization, and pressure. And the pressure when you're against the wall, and, you know, like, as you said, none of us who have gambling problems set out to become a problematic gambler. We start as an entertainment, and it does go along that continuum. But at some stage, whatever might be the catalyst that drives it from going from being a very valued person, saying I'd never do that, to kind of, oh, well, I'll just do it. You rationalize the behavior in that. I'll just take a little bit and I'll win it back and I'll pay it back and it's fine. Because you know the systems that you can kind of work it as well. But it's that the pressure bit, I think, is kind of like, it could be, you know, from being pressure from being away from your family, it could be pressure from trying to get all this money back to get back to that 0 point or whatever that looks like. And that drives behavior that's not the person. And then it's nearly like once you open that can of worms, it's very hard to kind of, you know, it just they flow out. And that's, you can snowball very, very quickly, as I did, and sounds like you did as well. You can snowball very, very quickly down this hill that's oblivion. And it's only when it bottoms out at the very end, it's when you kind of go, Jesus, did I do that? Because when I'm doing the presentation, I talk about stealing the 1.75 million. And the hair still stands in the back of my neck, even when I mentioned the figure, because I can. And then when you're looking at some of the bets you don't think, how did I even do that? Or and again, I take full responsibility for my actions within. But then you're going to go, but how did they allow that? How did they not say, you know, this person is totally out of control, he needs to stop? And you know, in your story, probably a little bit different than mine, they were constantly hitting you with huge amounts of money. And those huge amounts of money, like 5,000, you could say, like, you know, you could turn that into, you know, fix everything. And that's your belief that you can fix this.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem lies, because you're backed against the wall, and the only way you can feel that you can actually get out of the problem is by doing the exact thing that got you into the problem. I know that's the old adage, but that's really where it is. And you're so desperate, because I think you don't want to go looking for help. Even when the person said, if you come to us early, I can go, I'm not going to go to anyone early. I can fix this. I'm, you know, the ego, the pride, the fear, whatever it might be. And you're kind of going, I don't need anyone. I can do this myself. So look at that bet I done last year where I turned X into Y. And that's the feeling, the underlying feeling. And it can be a bit of ego. But then the VIP status kind of adds that. And you kind of go, like, I can't, I have to show a certain persona, and those masks have to be up to different people. And it's only when we hit that low point that all the masks come down, and then you suddenly you're looking at the vulnerable Tony, and you're kind of going, Christ, has this where it's become? And then that rebuilding process is absolutely, you know, immense.
Yeah, and if I can just come in there, I mean, this idea of dual accountability, like, that we're not here to bash bookies or bash casinos or bash the industry, right? That although they do a lot of really, really bad shit, almost universally, almost across the board. So I'm not bashing them either, but they could definitely do a whole lot better. But like, obviously, the individual who's gambling in an out of control way, they have to take responsibility for their actions. That's one part of the picture. The gambling operators who blatantly incentivize that out of control gambling have to take responsibility for their bit. And the government, who are supposed to regulate the whole bloody thing, have to take responsibility for their bit. But the whole story and the whole line, the whole way along up until now, has been, it's the person with the gambling problem. It's all their responsibility all of the time. That is not true, and it's not fair, right? And like, there needs to be at least, I think, a three-way accountability where it's person who's gambling, absolutely. I don't think you're trying not to take responsibility for your own actions at all. Also, the gambling operators, if they're behaving immorally, unethically, or in some cases illegally, they need to take responsibility for their actions. And then the government, who stands back and lets all this crap happen, also needs to take responsibility if they don't regulate it properly. So there's at least, I think, three-way responsibility. And I think you're honest enough to be able to put your hands up and
absolutely. I have to take responsibility for the actions that I did. And what I did, but it was evident that I had a problem. You know, I wasn't someone that all that money I lost, I wasn't someone that would put 20 grand on that or 50 grand. What I had to do was engage in this activity for time, like throughout. I wanted the engagement. So it wasn't huge, just bets here, but it was every race, spinning a wheel at the same time, watching it was every in play. It was evident that I, you know, they said it, didn't they, in court, Paddy Power, a wild man. You know, hearing that in court, this man is a wild man. That was like, they knew I'm out of control, I'm wild. But they continued to let it go on. And no one asked, where is this money coming from? If they had asked and done adequate checks, not just taken a payslip that I could print out and put any figure I want, checked my bank statements, matched up with my payslip, looked at my outcome, if they started questioning that, I'd have been like, oh my God, I'm gone. You know, I don't want them looking at this because they're going to find out actually where this, and I'm in trouble. And the whole thing about personal responsibility, but then just pointing the finger at the individual, I felt I was the only person in the world that had done these terrible things. I thought I was the only person that was the scum of the earth. And that they contributed to that because it's all your fault. And that adds to shame and that adds guilt. And for me, they're the things that lead to the suicidal thoughts. It's not the money. It's the shame and the guilt of what I've done. And it was really, really hard for me to get rid of that until I met other people who said, I would have done the same if I had that. I've done this and hear their stories. And it's that relatability. I didn't feel alone. I didn't feel alone anymore. And that's why I always believe in peer support, lived experience in this journey, because the industry and the regulator and the government have failed individuals and have put the blame all on their shoulders. And I'm fortunate that I'm here to tell this story. I didn't take the actions that had gone through my head and, Googling ways how to kill yourself and stuff like that, easy ways and quick ways, and oh my God, I can't do it here because this is my sister's flat, or this is my in-law's home, or this, someone's going to walk down this park and say, I'm so fortunate that I'm here, but there's so many that are not, because it's just that shame and guilt, I believe, and that thought of I'm not going to be able to stop this. I actually felt that this is going to change me if I stop. I'm going to be a bad person if I stop. But it was all them things. I can't stop. It's that out of control. It's powerlessness. I'll advocate for GA on that. That first step. Admit we are powerless over gambling. Our lives have become unmanageable. I realized that at the end. I didn't know it was that saying, but I realized that at the end, and it resonated with me when my first meeting in GA where I was on the floor. But no, I'm not here to bash. I'm not here to bash the industry. And that same VIP manager took me from Ladbrokes to Paddy Power.
That was something I wanted to ask you about, because you were, I don't know if poaching or headhunting is the correct term, or what's the one that Fergie used to do in football? Tapping up players from opposing teams, Berbatov or whoever, something like that happened where you're with Ladbrokes. Was it the VIP manager you had at Ladbrokes moved to Paddy Power and then wanted to bring maybe some of his client book with him to Paddy Power? Something like that? Can you give us the
details? I've sat with, his name's Tony as well. Jesus. I've sat with Tony before the court case, before Amma tried to take Paddy Power on. And I asked questions to him. I wanted to understand, because he had become someone that I thought was a friend, that, had met my family, had been to my home, helped me strip wallpaper when we were brought my son back from Dubai to the UK. We became friends. I thought we were friends. So what happened with him was he was at Ascot with Ladbrokes, and he was asked, whatever went on at Ladbrokes, he was asked to sort of leave his role, and they were going to give him early redundancy and whatever. We stayed in contact. He was actually the one that told me Ladbrokes had failed me and that I needed to bring it up with them. Later on, he comes to me and says, if I wanted an account with Paddy Power, it's a better app and it's better service and you'll get looked after and there'll be this VIP manager like you have, but I'm not going to be work. I'm just going to introduce you. And Tony, I can get you a £20,000 deposit match in your first deposit. you know, as a gambling addict, what am I going to say no, Tony? You know, now he never directly worked with them because he still was under whatever agreement with Ladbrokes. So this came to light that this introducer agreement was put in his wife's name. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. He told me that he was getting a percentage of my losses. You know, he said, look, I'm going to be getting a small percentage of your losses. If you want, I can give you that back. Like, I was like, no, don't worry. That's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Never knew it was going to be 25%. And like I say, I was a gambling addict. I'm a gambling addict. And at the time, I don't care about anything else but getting bets on and receiving these free bullets. And he got 25% of my losses. And, you know, the first month, my net losses was £103,000 with him. So, you know, him and his wife received £25,000. That's not the point here. The point is that he knew I had a problem. They knew I had a problem. They probably tapped him up, bring us your clients over, you know, from Ladbrokes. And they're ruthless. These businesses, this industry is ruthless, and they only care about profit. And that's what he did. And he took me over there. He asked me, did I have any friends that, you know, wanted to open an account and I could get a percentage of that. And I said, look, I've got friends that will do it. They don't gamble like me. And a few of my friends opened a account. I didn't want any of their losses, but my mates were over the moon with these free deposit matches. Naively, I did that, you know, but none of my friends that I did that to have a gambling disorder or addicted to gambling. I opened other accounts in other people's names to get, like, I said, oh, they're going to be, you know, big spenders with you. It was me spending on other people's accounts, getting the same deposit match. And, you know, he treated me and they treated me like a piece of meat. And meat to, you know, he threw me from them to them and didn't care. And they didn't care. And you, like I said, I've talked about how they described me, wild man, he's back. I think they described us, he's the new Tony. This is another Tony, I think they said. I think Aaron Robinson's book. You know, and I went to court. People don't know the full facts. Who I defrauded, apart from the last company I worked for, none of those people took action against me, legal action against me or criminal action against me. I left Dubai and admitted what I did and wanted to help them the best I could to get their money back, sold my home behind my wife's back to repay, gave all everything I had left to repay, but obviously it never covered the losses. So I wanted to help Emma and support Emma with that case, but to sit through that hearing when I was hearing those employees describe and be asked questions about what they were doing, you know, even like hospitality, we use hospitality to check that person's okay. Jesus Christ. They never turned up to any hospitality. I just got free tickets. You know, the VIP manager was never there. It was horrible. It was horrible. And the thing is, I know that they still treat people like that today. I know I'm not the only one. I know there's many, many people that are treated like that to different levels, but they did not care. And, you know, there's a stat, 5% of customers generate 80% of profits online. And those 5% of customers, I'd say a majority of them have probably got a gambling addiction and have had this service. And I'm not anti-gambling. Like you spoke at the start, Barry, about Cheltenham, people enjoy a bet and it's a social thing. And, you know, I, for those that can do it, I don't want to stop that. I'm not out there to stop that for those people, but the practices and the bombardment and the normalization and the harm that gambling causes, I want to stop. You know, a lot of my friends enjoy a bet, you know, do it within their means, but I don't care about them. I care about the people that are getting in this, that where they are being harmed, they are being exploited, where it's in front of children's faces every day, the bombardment, And that's what I'm anti. I'm anti that because if I had the right education as a child at school in gambling, I don't take drugs, I don't smoke, and I very rarely drink. And it's because I've seen things that worried me as a child around those things. Gambling, you know, and that education, I think, is imperative now. And everyone has responsibilities. And you know what? If you fail someone, and Tony has been there, and so many others, they've dealt with and faced the consequences of their actions. When this industry and when this regulator in this country let down people and fail them, they should be held accountable. Sorry, I went into one there, but
no, that's really good stuff, Tony. And I suppose just one thing, just to clarify for the listeners who may not be fully aware of your story, you mentioned a case there, a court case, a couple of times. If I have this correct, it was one of the people who you had defrauded took a case to try and recoup that money from Paddy Power. Do I have that correct?
Yeah.
They were unsuccessful, if I recall.
Yeah, I don't care about what I signed, but I was able to recover just under £1 million back from Ladbrokes for the individuals that were harmed from my gambling financially. But one of those individuals who was harmed for some of his money with Paddy Power took them on in court, and he lost, and he was unsuccessful, and you know, to find the trace of money and things like that, and I think the judge says I wasn't a credible witness. Bloody hell, like, what more could I do apart from go on a stand and admit it's the crime that I did, which I wasn't facing action for? But that was his opinion and his choice and his judgment. And he didn't get the money back. I could tell you, if you want to know where that money went to, which the Gambling Commission, because I can tell you now with the fine that Paddy Power received for that, and Paddy Power's wish to reimburse that individual back from the divestment of funds of the net losses, and then to be told by the Gambling Commission, no, don't give it back to him, and where that money ended up with, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So this man had to fight through courts and pay a huge amount of legal fees and because a regulator felt it wasn't right that you know, Paddy Power give that money back to him. They didn't want him to. That's a regulator that's there to protect consumer, prevent crime, and protect individuals. It was unbelievable. And he's a great man, and I still speak to him regularly, and he's forgiven me for what I did. But he didn't need to go through that. But what that showed is that actually is out there now in public. Their behaviour from behind the scenes, which you never would have got to see without that case. So it was huge for some of the work that people are trying to do.
Yeah, and I think, sorry, Tony O'Reilly, I know you want to come in just briefly, but I think just before today's show, I was looking at some of the newspaper articles around that case. I think while obviously the guy who was trying to recoup his money was unsuccessful in his case, the judge was fairly damning of Paddy Power's behaviour towards you, if I remember that part correctly. Yeah, I think so. Tony O'Reilly, you had something there?
Just to come in on, totally resonates, everything that Tony said resonates with me totally. It's like I'm reliving my own kind of story. And that's the bit, we're not here, as you said, as bookie bashers, but I think it is important to call out some of that behaviour because, look, as I have always said, when my news broke back in 2011, I can accept that it was a different landscape back then when it comes to safer gambling and even gambling addiction wasn't really as recognised as it is now. And that's because of the brilliant work of a lot of people, including getting it into the DSM-5 and research and all that. And I can accept, right, there was failings in my case. I can accept that. I've made peace with that bit. But reading Aaron Rogan's book, especially the chapter on myself and yourself that's in it, and my blood was boiling reading that, kind of because the failings are they're so blatant, and the bit that always gets me, and I always, because again, we're not anti-gambling, we are anti-gambling harm, but historically Paddy Power, the same company that was involved in mine, the same failings were in your case, and the same failings are still coming through our doors each day when it comes to people seeking help and support for gambling. And it's all put back on the individual, as we know, from their safer gambling messages when the fun stops and take time to think and et cetera, et cetera. But that's the bit that gets me most. I can accept the failings in mine. I'm sure you can probably accept some of the failings in yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like your people are reaching out to you week in, week out, or reaching out to us week in, week out, and it's still happening. And you know, and over here, while there is regulation in the UK, we've nothing over here. And that's the bit that really gets to me more than anything else. Because I like yourself, I hold my hand up. I did wrong. I stole money. But I wasn't in a fit mind at any of those stages. Like, you know, they Google mapped my house to see if I had money. And then one of them stopped and said, we thought it was the Russian mafia. We thought it was, you got an inheritance from your auntie. That doesn't take away the fact that
they thought it was the Russian mafia, but they still took the money.
Yeah.
It's a bit apt in this current climate. But it was like, even if that was the case, you still allowed me, no matter where the money came from, and you knew I was a manager of the post office, and all the money went over two counters. It wasn't like I was siphoning it into different accounts to kind of hide my tracks. I wasn't able to hide my tracks, so I was a gambling addict. And it was like, it was still never kind of like, they still allowed me to gamble a turnover of 10.5 million to lose probably in excess of 1.75 million over an 8-year period to them. And the majority of that actually in the last 6 months, and not at any stage. And you said it did spike at a certain time, and not at any stage was it kind of, well, where's this money coming from? Or where's this, like, even, I know we're going over old ground, but even from a money launder point of view, it was never even that. And even like that's, it just beggars belief to me how it's still the same now, 12 years on. And that's the bit that gets my blood boiling. And then Aaron Drogan booked a brilliant book, if anyone hasn't read it, to highlight all the failings. But yet it's kind of still, like as Barry said, the judge was damning of Paddy Power. But then it's kind of like, that's forgotten about this week because we're all having great crack with Cheltenham. And all these stories, when they do come to light, it's very important. But then they kind of just like, it's such a huge juggernaut of a business that kind of paints this entertainment. These stories get lost. It's like, oh, it's the wild one. It's Tony P, the wild one, or the new Tony, or whatever way they want to put it. They're the exceptions to the rule, but we're not the exceptions to the rule.
No.
Because it's not just amounts of money. It's the time. It's the people who haven't been able, who lose their lives because of this. And they're being failed systematically by the government, by the bookie operators, by everyone. And that's why we need to be, you know, saying this, why we're not bookie bashing. We probably are, and I don't care if I am. But that we need to be shouting this from the rooftop. And there's some brilliant organizations in the UK doing that at the moment, as we're all aware. Myself and Barry, as much as we can, and some other, Colin O'Gar and some other people in the space over here, we're doing it. And I do believe the tide is turning. But by Jesus, why did it have to take? Why is it taking so long for the turn? It's a simple solution to this problem.
There's so much, you know, again, the relatability between us. But the thing is, I can relate with the person that hasn't yet stolen that money and they're spending everything they earn or every benefit they get, and those same failings are still happening. You know, them same questions are sometimes being asked, and then, okay, well, you're on benefits and you get X amount. It's fine. You can carry on still gambling for your benefits and more. You know, all of this stuff, and you probably heard, when I talk about that, my voice probably changes. There's a bit of anger in me, and that, you know, from going talking about recovery and family and friends, and because it is still in me, because it's frustrating that these things can be preventable, and sometimes people can't control that themselves, and they, you know, they need that assistance, they need that, and they need interject, like, we're stopping you. Even if you say you're okay, we're stopping you, because I've said all them years before, all the signs were there for me, all the things that happened, I still couldn't stop. I needed someone to cut me up and cut me off, sorry, from my gambling. You know, at the end, I wanted to be in jail or in the ground, because that's the only way I thought I could stop, being locked up or being in the ground. And those were the two choices. I wanted to get caught or I wanted to be dead. And that was that moment when things changed. You know, they did change, and, you know, regulation, if you haven't got it out there, I'll tell, don't follow the Gambling Commission's footprint here, because it's they're failing people, they're failing individuals, they're the consumer who they're there to protect are disappointed with them. You know, learn, right? Hope you guys can learn from that them and their failings, and government as well. And yes, we have got the Gambling Act review, which, you know, is amazing. But until we see that white paper, who knows what's going to happen? And like you say, harm will always be there, and people some people will have gambling addiction, but it's bringing those numbers down, and we're only going to do that with, for me, the correct education, the correct support, the correct treatment, the correct regulation, and the correct practices from the industry. Because this is a two-way relationship. You know, when you're gambling, there's two people in this, and sometimes they're the only people that know what's actually going on. You know, if it's like me, a hidden addiction that, you know, not many people, they know the reality. They know what I'm spending. They know how much time, and I, they probably know it more than, knew it more than me, because in that mist, it wasn't until you sit down and you put your D's on, you work and you think, my God, what have I done? Like, oh my, that is the reality then, not when, for me when I was in it. So it's a two-way thing.
Exactly. And as Barry knows, I love my analogies. And when you were saying that, it was like, it's like you said, we need someone to stop us. And I'll use the analogy of the head injuries and that's been brought in. And rightly so, like, you know, when someone gets concussed, the player will always want to play on. They're buzzing, trying to get back onto the pitch. But now they have these protocols in place, because the player won't see it as an issue, or they'll just think they're fine, but they're not. They're probably concussed, but don't realize it. And as someone with a gambling addiction, as you said last time, you don't even realize we have it. We need that person to say, hold on, no, you do have it, even though we don't want to stop. You need to stop, because there's something not quite right here. And that's what we need. We need that in the gambling industry. We need it in the government. We need it in betting shops. We need it in casinos. We need it online. And the information is there online to be able to step in and do that. But lots of times that's not happening. So I let Barry in there, because I only go on the rant. Barry, instead of going.
No, I mean, Tony, you both make great points. And Tony Parenti, you're making the point there that, of course, the gambling industry have the bird's eye view of what's going on here, right? They can, and especially if you're kind of loyal, and they're using the VIP system to keep you loyal to one brand. Tony O'Reilly was only ever with Paddy Power with his online account. So they are seeing all of your gambling. If they have all your loyalty, they have all your gambling. They know they're sitting there bored on a Tuesday doing their work. They can log in. They can see, oh, look, Tony Wildman Parente is doing the usual thing again, right? They're stone cold sober, you would imagine, at work. And they can see it with a clear mind, and they know what's going on. You are in the midst of full-blown active addiction. You're not thinking clearly. And that's the same whether it's gambling, heroin, cocaine, alcohol, or anything else, right? One of the defining characteristics is you're not thinking clearly. You're not doing things that you would normally do. And like both myself and Tony O'Reilly are former bartenders, there's, you know, you're the responsible person in that scenario. Somebody comes up to the bar, they're legless drunk. You, the bartender, have to say, look, sorry, mate, you had enough today. Do you want me to call you? Come, taxi, whatever it might be. Come back tomorrow. No harm, no foul, right? You have to be, you, the vendor of the addictive product, have to be the responsible person in that situation. That's part of your job, as part of your duty of care. You're selling addictive stuff to people, and you can see that it's having a really harmful impact on them, and they've lost control with that addictive stuff. It's on you to do the responsible thing, right? Not to fleece them, right?
Yeah.
Not to fleece
them. Like what you just said there, addictive products, addictive index. They just need to even highlight that this is an addictive product. This is an addictive activity. They don't even do that. There's no warning to what you're engaging in. This can be not to everyone, but can be addictive. It's got this, you know, even warnings like that. Someone might think, oh, no, thank you. Then there's nothing on that operator. There's nothing on them to try to be responsible, but they're letting people know what they're engaging in. You know, it's on alcohol, isn't it? Like I said, I'm not a big drinker, but I'm sure they give you percentages of how much alcohol's in there and stuff. Just a bit of awareness. Do it. You know, don't tell us that this is just fun. And I hate it. 30 million people enjoy a gamble, you know, from Mr. Duggar. You know, okay. But I can guarantee you there's more than 400,000 people that suffer with a gambling disorder or addicted to gambling and things like that. you just don't know about them, you haven't heard about them. And me and Tony will not be the last Tonys, and we will not be the last person. And how great it would be if in 10 years' time there isn't another story of this. But the problem and reality is, until things really change, there will be. There will be those stories. There will be those suicides. There will be that criminality. There will be those broken relationships. There will be that loss of time. It will happen because we hear it every day, you know, in what we do and what we see and who reaches out to us, you know. And, yeah. And hopefully we can help that person and intervene. But at that work, when you say you're in the midst, one of the old guys from GA, he said to me, you're a pathological gambler, Tony. Pathological, like pathological, you can't see through anything when you're doing what you're doing. That's why I couldn't stop. If I could, I would have done. It came to a moment where I had to, but that takes support, that takes help, that takes honesty, that takes connection, takes so much. You can't just do it on your own.
Yeah, I mean, God, we could talk about this all day, and you're so right. And look, we've mentioned two gambling operators today, Ladbrokes and Paddy Power. To be fair to all the other ones, you're all equally as bad as far as I can see. just to be fair here, we don't want to just bash Ladbrokes and Paddy Power, because we know we're on the front line. We hear all the stories about what all you guys are up to, and you can go in front of the government and you can go in Ireland.
Talk about
all the wonderful things that you're doing and all the wonderful interventions that you have. We know the real story. We see it every day. So we will be equal opportunity bashers here. We just want to make that.
Yeah, I can only talk about the experiences I had. But yeah, like I say, I hear from a lot more others.
Yeah.
Different. They're all at it, and they can all do better.
Absolutely. Tony Parenti, I mean, before we finish up today, you've been extremely generous with your time. And like, I suppose we all have to kind of get back and do our day job stuff. Tell us a bit about Gamlearn, which is the charity that you founded, and what you're doing there, and how people could kind of get in touch or avail of your service or get involved.
So I set up Gamlearn to help people that want to learn more around themselves and around the addiction and just learn. It's in there. Learn is the lived experience and recovery network. And I'd like us to be part of a network where people can connect with each other in a safe space after sort of obtaining help and things like that. We're not a treatment or provider. We offer free training to our members and being part of workshops and meetups and just inform them about things that are going on, like things, great things like the Big Step Walk or the rally last week at Westminster and in London. It wasn't at Westminster particularly, but We're just trying to help people after treatment. And for me, if we can just connect people together in a safe space, there are various spaces to do it. Some are not as good as they were. We tried to do it in a safe space. And for me, it's just, I was able to benefit from learning and developing myself through organizations and opportunities that I had. I was fortunate to have those jobs and be able to do that. Not everyone has that. So we do things like suicide prevention training. We've got Matt Peskell coming to do Addiction by Design. We're going to be doing some safeguarding training. So we're a very, very new charity, and we're just trying to be another place where people can go to that have lived experience and want to connect. And you can go onto our website, gamlearn.org.uk, and see what we're doing there. And the more people we can get, the better. And like I say, I thought about Gamlearn because of my own journey and what helped me. And I'm just trying to implement a little bit of that to others. And we work very closely with support services, and we can signpost people to various support services, which we do. But for me, connecting people is the most important thing, I think, in our journeys going forward. And that's what we're trying to do.
Oh, fair play for doing that, Tony. I mean, can people from Ireland get in contact and other parts of the world?
Anyone can join up. Our new site has just been launched. The members form there is there. If they have lived experience, affected others as well. We want this community to grow. We want to hear from them. We want to hear ideas from them, what more we can do, how we can work better. So yeah, anyone can join, and most of our meetings are on Zoom. But yeah, anyone,
Brilliant. And just to be clear, I know we've done a fair bit of bookie bashing today, although he's probably said at the start that we wouldn't, but that always changes midstream anyway. But you know, the meetings, I imagine, aren't about that. They're about people in recovery. It's nothing to do with bookie bashing. It's just about people moving through their own recovery journey and obviously meeting other people who are a bit further down the line and people who are in different places. And I suppose making that connection and learning from others and maybe leaning on others sometimes as well. So
that's the thing. We've told members what they want. Do they want to receive a newsletter? Do they want to come to just meetups? Do they want to be on some of our workshops? Do they want to get the free training? So we're giving them the option to say what they want. You know, if they don't want to be at a rally doing what we're doing, that's fine. You know, there's different parts of what we can do. But for me, the most important thing is people knowing that there's another space and another option for them where that relatability, I just think is unbelievable. And it was a huge part of my own journey and still continues to be. So I hope we can be that for someone else.
Brilliant. Tony O'Reilly, any last thoughts before we finish up?
No, I suppose just on the gambler, and I sat in on one or two of the sessions, one especially with Matt Gaskell, which I thought was absolutely excellent. So it's great that you're bringing, you know, these workshops to people so they can get a better understanding. I know that he'd done a lot about the addiction by design concept, and I think for a lot of people in recovery or working through the recovery, to understand the nuts and bolts behind the product can be a big part in their recovery as well. So I found it hugely beneficial. And I just want to again thank you for your time and your honesty. It was a powerful podcast today, and at a time maybe when a couple of our listeners need it in the week that's in it. And I'd make no apologies for bookie bashing. Generally, I don't. But I think sometimes we need to vent. And that's the same in recovery as well. We need to vent what's on our minds to clear it out of our heads so we can remain as balanced as possible, which myself and Barry struggle at times, me probably more so. At times, Barry is the one that reins me in. And that's why you talk about connections. I have plenty of these different connections where I reach out or I have these people in my life who can really rein me in when I need to be reined in. And vice versa, I'm sure. And Barry goes on a rant about a few things. We generally do that over text or our own conversations. But it's brilliant to have you on. Again, I've only briefly met you before. I know we had a conversation yesterday. Or Monday, was it yesterday or Monday? I can't even remember. Each day is morphing into each other because of the busyness. But at a time when we're generally more, you know, busier after Cheltenham as well. I suppose looking at our own two stories, two probably the extreme ends of the spectrum or the continuum, the one thing I always get from it is that there is hope, there is recovery. And for anyone who feels that isn't the case, just listen to people like myself, other people who talk about their recovery, whether it's on the bigger stage or whether it's in GA meetings or whatever it is that you can have a life after this. And the one thing that I took from today is that your life is tenfold, 100 times better than what it was while you're in active addiction. And that's the one message I try to put out there each time I'm speaking about my journey, is that it's not about the story of addiction, because we can all focus in on the big figure as well. It's a story of resilience. It's a story of the ability to bounce back from adversity and go through all this crap that we've gone through. We'll come out the far side and be fairly balanced in our arguments around, you know, the failings of the industry or government or whatever, but to show that there is hope past this. And I think that's the one thing I really got from today.
Yeah, Tony, thank you. And yeah, we've talked a little bit about that, but for me, if someone can listen to this today and relate to any of it and might not be in that stage to sort of have any hope, you know, and think that there's no way out and they're not going to be able to stop. I thought the same, you thought the same, and we were able to do so. And that's the thing, you want to, let's be honest, inspire and give those people hope. And that's what I got from so many individuals on my journey. You know, that when I came into that room and thought, I've got no hope here. And then I heard that story and he inspired me, and 13 years off a bet and he did things like this. There's hope for me. And that's what I hope people get out of it. The boogie bashing thing, as you say, is something that will come up because it's personable to me. It's a huge part of my journey, but a bigger part is actually getting the right help, the right support and the want and the will, and to be inspired by others to stop. And, you know, we all try and do that. And that's why we're here telling our stories and sharing our experiences. I think that's at the forefront of everything I do, and I'm sure it is with you guys.
Tony Parente, we can't say it any better than that. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time today and for everything that you're doing just to raise awareness around this and to inspire people and to give them that bit of hope when they're in a dark place to realize, well, look, recovery is possible. There are people who've been through very, very severe addictions and come out the other side. Like, people need to know that. It's so important. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And thank you very much, guys.
For tuning in, dear listeners. We'll see you next time.
See you later.
The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more. We'll be right back.